Good morning. As Amy said, my name is Katie Berger, and I'm on staff with InterVarsity Christian Fellowship here on campus, and it's my privilege to be a member of this church and to be here worshiping with you all this morning. And in the wake of hearing about such profound and weighty news, it strikes me that it's appropriate to head into the scripture and to go to the book that guides us in the big scope of things that happen, in matters of life and death, and in the smaller things of how we live our day-to-day lives. So we'll go ahead and do that together now. So I want to open with a story. A number of years ago, I was at a retreat, and I went to a seminar the afternoon of the retreat, and the seminar was led by a spiritual director. And the spiritual director wanted to help us connect with how we were doing, think about the state of our souls, and she wanted us to do that using more of our imaginations than just our words. And I don't know if you have ever been part of one of these exercises where you hear it described and you're like, yeah, right? You probably have if you've been in something I was leading, because I tend to use them. But in this case, I was really hating on what she was about to do and was doubting where it was going. So the task she described was we were going to have a piece of paper in front of us and a pen, close our eyes, and move the pen around the paper. And then pray that God would help us as we looked at just these random markings on the page, see something that helped us understand where we were at, or something that maybe described an image of something going on with us internally or our souls. So as we went to close our eyes to do this, I kind of rolled my eyes but closed them and start drawing. And when she prays for us and we open our eyes, I pick up my paper and I'm adjusting it around, and my eyes kind of like went big because it worked. On this weird scribble I'd made, I began to see kind of this image of something that looked sort of like a mountain. My pen had gone up that way. And then something kind of swirly that was like a person climbing the mountain with this big bag they were carrying over their shoulders. And when I saw that, it was almost like my heart skipped a beat. It was like, whoa, that is totally what I'm feeling right now. If you had asked me to use my words at that time to describe, I would have said, it's been a really busy season. There have been a lot of urgent needs presented to me in the last several months. I feel very, very tired. But I never would have said in that moment, just responding, and it feels like this heavy burden I'm carrying as I climb up a mountain. And in that season, as I'd seen this image, and I mean, it stuck with me enough. This was over 10 years ago, and I can describe it to you now. It was really profound. I began to wrestle with some things about how my life was going, about what I was carrying. And as I looked into the bag, I found some things. I mean, I was really surprised what was there because they were good things. They were things God would want me to do. So I looked in the bag and I found that I had been involved in several areas of ministry that were just really critical and were moving forward at that point. And I needed to give a lot of myself in those settings. I found a great friend of mine going through a crisis that was asking for a lot of time. I needed to care for her in certain ways, and I was traveling to do some of it. I found some traveling for celebratory events. I had been to a bunch of weddings and showers and birthday parties that were all over town and in town and just scattered all over the place. And I found several conflicts that were going on around me that I was working hard to be a reconciler in, to participate with people to help them get somewhere else. Those all sound pretty good, right? These are all things God would invite me to do. They're important. They're valuable. They're meaningful in my community. And yet the whole of all of these experiences together was a weight and a burden over my shoulder. And during those months, I came across the end of the passage we'll study this morning. And to be honest with you, it felt like a straight-up lie. These are familiar words, but imagine in that moment where I'm noticing I'm carrying this heavy bag of things for God, think of how they'd land. Jesus says in Matthew 11, 28 to 30, "Come to me, all you who are weary and burdened, and I will give you rest. Take my yoke upon you and learn from me, for I am gentle and humble in heart, and you will find rest for your souls. For my yoke is easy and my burden is light." And I had to take this up with Jesus because I feel like, Jesus, I'm here doing all of this for you. I'm playing out the life that it seems like we should be living together. And you're saying I should feel rest and a lack of weariness. And that is not what's happening here. And it took many months. And I'd say even in some ways, I keep working through that. But I wonder if many of you have felt this tension. If we read a passage like that and it taps into something we long for, our hearts kind of pitter-pat with it, like, yes, I want that. And then we step back and go, I have no idea how to get there. I don't think I'm there right now. Well, fortunately, those three verses don't sit alone at the end of the passage. They're actually the end of an entire sermon that Jesus has been preaching in the first 24 verses of the chapter, and then picks up in our passage for this morning. And Jesus provides more framing and more answer than that standalone little nugget we take. And we're going to spend this morning looking at that, how Jesus helps us be able to receive his easy yoke. So, context going into our passage for this morning, Pastor Steve brought us to the end of chapter 10 last week, and we're picking up at the end of chapter 11. But in between, here's what's happened. John the Baptist has been imprisoned, and while in prison, apparently is starting to wonder, did I actually get this right, Jesus? Are you the Messiah? So he sends his disciples to ask Jesus, is it true? Were you the one? Jesus answers in front of other people, listing all of the things that have happened that would be scripture references to indicate that he is indeed the Messiah, and says, John, I bless you for sticking with me in the faith. So he answers yes without saying the direct word yes and sends word back to John. And right from there, he continues on saying to the crowds, you have seen so many signs from me and from John in our ministry. You've seen so many signs that if you are not yet seeing that I'm the Messiah, it's because you don't want to. And from there, we pick up with today's passage. So I'll read Matthew 11, 25 to 30. It's on the slides, or feel free to pull out your Bible. So at that time, Jesus said, I praise you, Father, Lord of heaven and earth, because you have hidden these things from the wise and learned and revealed them to little children. Yes, Father, for this is what you were pleased to do. All things have been committed to me by my Father. No one knows the Son except the Father, and no one knows the Father except the Son and those to whom the Son chooses to reveal him. Come to me, all you who are weary and burdened, and I will give you rest. Take my yoke upon you and learn from me, for I am gentle and humble in heart, and you will find rest for your souls. For my yoke is easy and my burden is light. Okay, so I said adding more to this helps us understand it. I don't feel like up front it helps me understand it that much more. In those five verses, there are three concepts that at first feel kind of unrelated to me. So we hear something about the wise and learned and little children. We hear something about Jesus and the Father and their relationship. And then we hear this famous, often quoted invitation. If it were me writing this, I would skip those middle sections and go right from Jesus saying, you've seen all these signs and yet you've chosen not to believe, to appealing to them, but come. All of you, I want you to come. I want you to believe. Come. But Jesus doesn't do it that way. Jesus instead takes these intervening verses to explain the barrier that the people who have seen it all but have not yet received it have had. And then, with them positioned to understand, invites them again. So let's get into those intervening verses. And we see right away, the first sentence of the passage, there's a contrast set up between the wise and learned and the little children. So Jesus has hidden, saying something's been hidden from the wise and learned and revealed to the little children. Who are the wise and learned? The wise and learned are, it's language that suggests a group of people who think they really know what's going on. They think they know what Jesus should be doing, what God should be doing at this moment of salvation history. So they've studied their scriptures a lot and have come to very narrow interpretations, often wrong, of what God's about and what he's up to. They particularly do that around the coming of the Messiah. So at this time in history, all the Jewish cities are living under oppressive foreign rule. So they're part of the Roman Empire. They're no longer autonomous or leading themselves. And the wise and learned people believe that when the Messiah comes, he will come in military victory and push back that oppressive force and leave them in freedom. And they think the way they will get this to happen is by a strict national adherence to the law. So if every Jewish person follows every law that God has given them, then when that happens, snap, the Messiah will come. And they're really attached to this interpretation, so much so that they are working hard to influence others to do the same thing. And all together really confident if we can get this done, we can get the Messiah to come and gain freedom again. So that's the wise and learned. On the other side, we have the little children. So the little children in the Greek is actually infants. But the author is not setting up that we have a group of infants over here and some old wise and learned people. The term infants is actually a metaphor for a spiritual state. So an infant, right, we've seen them. There's some here this morning. They're helpless, they're vulnerable, they're needful. And when Matthew describes the infant there. He's describing a group of people who really don't have agency. They just know their need. They need something to be different in their lives. And they have no prediction or investment in exactly how God will rescue them at all. So the wise and learned and the little children both actually really need and long for the Messiah. But only one group is positioned to hear him when he comes in his own way. So it's tempting to read the phrase, "You have hidden these things from the wise and learned and revealed them to little children," as God proactively excluding the wise and learned. It's really what it sounds like. God said, nope, they can't know, only these people can. But what's actually true is that there should be, in this sense, no such thing as the wise and learned. So when seen in proper relation to God the Father who is revealing all of this, no person on the earth could be seen as wise and learned. When compared to God the Father, we all show up as infants. And as Jesus lays out this dichotomy, he's suggesting that it's time for them to make a choice, to see themselves in right relation to God for who they are and accept what he's doing, or to stay fixed in their interpretation and what they understand, what they know, and miss out on the whole thing. So let's play this out just a little more specifically. What does the group of wise and learned look like? What's their behavior like as opposed to the little children? So the wise and learned are operating with undue self-importance, while the little children are doing something more like accurate or even a low-level sense of self-value. The wise and learned are claiming what should be. It ought to happen this way. While the little children are living what is. I'm hungry. I'm thirsty. Today I have my needs. The wise and learned narrowly expect from God. They do expect he's going to do something, right? They think the Messiah will come, but they think they've got it just down. So it's going to happen just like this. It's narrow. Where the little children are hungry in their desire for God. The wise and learned then feel self-sufficient. They are working hard to operate the plan. They think they've got it and they can go about making it happen. While the little children are just sitting in active need for God. Now, which of these groups do we think would be ready to receive the Messiah when he comes in his own way? May we all be like the little children. The key to the Lord's rest is this childlike posture towards Jesus, humble and needful, not self-important or self-sufficient. The key to the Lord's rest is this childlike posture, that's humble and needful, not self-important and self-sufficient. So that's the key. That's the first thing Jesus says about this space between the indictment of you haven't heard and the place to hear the promise and the invitation. And then the second thing that happens, I've got the metaphor, they've opened the door with the key, and now they're standing in the threshold. They're not in the room yet, but they've got the posture. They could be ready to hear what Jesus has to say. So what happens in the doorway? And this is verses 27 and 28. The first thing we see is that Jesus tells them what we've understood, that he is the revealer. So though the wise and learned are pretty confident they know, Jesus is saying, no, you can't. I'm the revealer, I'm the only one who gets it. And the verse there is, all things have been committed to me by my Father. No one knows the Son except the Father, and no one knows the Father except the Son, and those to whom the Son chooses to reveal him. So Jesus has been given all of the authority to share with people how this messianic era is coming forward. And we see, because of this space in between, the indictment and the invitation, that Jesus really wants everyone to get it. So not only is he the revealer, and he comes and he says it, but he's the revealer in the sense that he's the one ever the teacher who takes this space to help them get it. If I were Jesus, I would just jump from one to the other. I told you already. But Jesus says, no, we're going to take a bunch of space here, and we're going to do a paradigm shift. I'm going to let you make this transition of how you think about yourself before I say it again. I'm going to say it again, come. And so we also see there that Jesus, in this gradual process of revelation, is also the inviter. In verse 28, Jesus says, come to me, all of you who are weary and burdened, and I will give you rest. So Jesus invites all these people, whoever can hear, whoever is ready to know their need, after he's given them a chance to change their perspective of what's going on, to come. Jesus is the inviter here. And so this doorway, standing in the doorway before entering in, what's happening there is the people are in a needful posture, accepting the invitation that only Jesus can make. So to go through the doorway, they have to be in a needful posture, accepting the invitation that only Jesus can make. And once they've done that, we come to the end of the passage. We're back in this familiar territory. There's some promise of what will happen when living in the Lord's rest. So 29 and 30 say, "Take my yoke upon you and learn from me, for I am gentle and humble in heart, and you will find rest for your souls. For my yoke is easy and my burden is light." So to all that have accepted the invitation comes the beautiful promise. You're going to find rest for your souls. You're going to find this easiness, this light burden. And what's happening here is Jesus is actually defining the burden. So the term yoke is not all that familiar to us in modern society, but in that era, it would have been a common reference, and it referred to two things. The first is physically what a yoke is. So a yoke was a piece of wood that would have been fastened to two animals to help them pull a heavy load together so that the weight was distributed between them. Everyone would have known that. And the other thing this mostly Jewish audience would have known was that there was a phrase being used by the rabbis and teachers of the time calling the people to take on the yoke of the kingdom of God. And so the request of the people in that call was that they would put on this yoke and that they too would work hard to bear the burden of getting to this strict national adherence to the law. So everyone worked together, putting on this yoke and pulling the weight to hopefully get the Messiah to come. It sounds heavy. It sounds kind of exhausting. And so when Jesus shows up here, he says, "My yoke," it's not the yoke of the kingdom of God, it's personal. It's "my yoke is easy, my burden is light." Jesus defines this burden then as something that's carried by the one, that is given to them by the one who is gentle and humble in heart. And rather than being this toiling, this ploy to follow the law to get something else to happen, Jesus is the one who made the law and he knows the purpose of it. So the law, in fact, was for the people, not for an admission ticket to get the kingdom to come. The law was so that the people could live in relationship with God. And that is how Jesus teaches. And we see throughout the gospel, Jesus showing up and reframing an understanding of the law to say, this is for your good. So the definition of the burden changes because Jesus is the one who places it on. And the load of the burden changes because Jesus co-carries it with the people he gives it to. And that's how we get to verse 30, "My yoke is easy and my burden is light." Because the one who is gentle and humble in heart walks alongside with this yoke, carrying the weight of it. And I imagine this, the Lord of the universe need not do that, and yet he chooses to carry the burden alongside the people. So I imagine that every step together, carrying the burden, you can look right at Jesus and know what he's doing, to know he's carrying it, and that is what Jesus says he's doing. He carries the burden with them. The yoke is easy, and the burden is light. And when we stay in this posture of need, we remember to turn to him again and again, and we can see what the load really is. It's a load of good things given to us that are carried with the one who gives it. And so living in the Lord's rest means that we are aware of our ongoing need. We come again and again and again and again to Jesus to define and provide for that reality. So aware of our ongoing need, coming again and again to Jesus to define and provide for our reality. So I shared as I introduced about this wake-up call, this image of myself climbing a mountain with a bag of burdens on my back. And it took me, as I said, many months and even years to work on what that meant and how to live a different life. So at that period of my life, one of the things I realized is that I was living much closer to the posture of the wise and learned than I would have liked or I would have thought. So when I look back and think of the kind of work I was doing, I see that self-sufficiency. I see that toiling. I see that self-importance. I was the one who had to get it done, who had to get in there and give everything I had to make this thing, all these good things for God, happen. And when it comes to work, we saw that. That's how the wise and learned were seeing it, right? We've all got to do it. Take that yoke and go. Let's grind. And that plays through then in how everything goes and how everything feels. But I'd like to suggest that the kind of work and partnership God invites us to is much more like the kind of work we give a small child. So my son Jack is 18 months old, and he's in that really cute phase where he's enthusiastic about everything. So he runs everywhere, he smiles all the time, he knows the sign for more and says it, so everything's like, more? Like, the best thing you could ever have is more of whatever's happening. So I thought, it's time. We need to capitalize on this enthusiasm and teach him how to be a contributor to the household. I'm going to give Jack a job. So I did. I thought, what's something he could care about? Like, feeding the dog. That's a good job we can do together. Right. So I'm a new parent. You're seeing that, right? So we can feed the dog. So we start this little routine in the mornings, and we go into the laundry room. I scoop, like, the actual amount of food the dog needs, and then Jack has a little baby bowl, and he can put some pieces in or scoop it or whatever, and we'll walk over, and we'll feed the dog together. And then he gets the satisfaction. Max, the dog, is fed. He's learned a little something. It took a little time in the morning. That was kind of nice, and that's what's going on. Well, we have paused that job. Because instead of this beautiful partnership and learning to do things with mom in a fun way, it turned out that the dog food has become the most interesting sensory table in the house. So every time the door is open to the laundry room, Jack's in there stirring up the food and dumping things left and right. There's never been so much dog food all over our house. But the point still stands. When Jesus gives us work, when God invites us to partnership with him, it is much more in this tone. God could get the work done any way he wants. He does not need us to show up. I can feed that dog, right? I don't need Jack to do it with me, but I want to invite him along so that he learns something about what we're about what needs to happen in the house, so that he gets the delight in getting something accomplished and being part of what we're all doing together. And that's how God is giving us work and things to do. He's handing us things as little children who can delight in it with him, who can learn along the way. And when we take on the work we're given, the things we need to do and participate in, we often do that in our culture these days much more from this sense of self-sufficiency and burden and grasping and working so hard to get it done. Now, there's nothing wrong with hard work, right? Jesus does lots of hard work. In my little metaphor there, Jack's happily taking this stuff back and forth. There's nothing wrong with doing the work. It's the posture behind it. It's what we believe about ourselves as we're doing it. So when I look back at that bag of burdens, I told you about some of the things that were in there. Here are ways I see my self-sufficiency playing out. So instead of just helping my friend in this season of crisis and doing what I could, I became like a one-woman care team. So anything I could come up with that she needed, I was trying to throw it at her, provided it was long distance, doing everything I could so that I could accomplish as much as possible for her. Instead of discerning which of these like celebratory events I should go to within my resources of time and energy and money, I went to all of them because I felt like my presence here really matters to communicate how much I care. And there's no other way to show up as well and as fully to show I care about my friends is getting to every single thing. As I was part of these conflicts and trying to help them work out to reconcile people, I showed up with an energy that demanded reconciliation. And an option that I would be the one to facilitate that happening if they'd take it, rather than waiting through a process God would have people go through to get them ready and prepared for it. And even in planning ministry events, there's so many of those in my life, but I felt like the events would live or die based on my involvement. And I went after that with a tenacity that was more than God had asked me to do. So what I realized, of course, is that all of this has added up instead of doing work for God in a playful partnership way alongside him like a little child, I was a person emotionally climbing a mountain with a giant bag of burdens on my back. And I was questioning the very promises God had given about rest and about what his burden would be like. So I have had to reckon with that. And really, my orientation all the time would be that kind of hard charging if I let myself, I would be after it like that. But God has said, no, I want to ask you for something else. And so what it's meant for me over the years is I've had to learn to notice and have ways I pay attention to seeing when I'm operating in that self-sufficiency. I've had to choose to forego that and instead cultivate that childlike needfulness for God's presence. And I've had to come to Jesus again and again to help him define for me the burden and understand that he's carrying it with me. So I'm going to take you through that process in just one small example that happened recently. This example is so small, but it's perfect because our life is mostly about the accumulation of the small things, right? The way we are and the way we live is much more about every little moment tied together than some grand moment that defines it all. So a couple of weeks ago, I was on a trip. I traveled for 5 days. And when we left for that trip, all of us headed out the door, and then Austin came back to work, and my parents kept Jack during the week. And when we'd left the house, it had been in kind of a frenzy, so the house was a big mess. And I had asked Austin when he got home, could he take care of the house, clean things up, do the dishes, whatever, and he said yes. So we travel, we recollect ourselves, we all arrive home 3 days after Austin had gotten home, 5 days after we'd all left, and I walk in to the kitchen, and just out of the corner of my eye, I see dishes on the counter. And immediately, I am ticked. Like, I asked you to do one thing, and you just played video games in your free time, and, you know, I've immediately made up a whole story of what happened while I was gone. Well, shame on me, because I walk further into the kitchen, and I see those two dishes were the remnants of one meal that he had fed himself that are sitting on the counter, and there's nothing else. I turn the corner into our living room. There are no toys anywhere. They're all put away. He had actually done exactly what I wished, but my auto response was to quick judgment and criticism and accusation. And the truth is, for me, most often I can quickly find when I'm living in a place of self-sufficiency when I look at my social behavior, when I look at the things I'm doing in relation to and in front of other people. So I have a list up here of other kinds of examples for that that could help you determine which you're living into. But for me, that quickness to criticize is just one of those places I can feel it and I can notice something's out of whack here. So in that case, when I realized something was out of whack, it was up to me to then decide, do I keep living in this? Do I just get crankier and crankier and look for more mistakes? Or am I going to adjust something in partnership with Jesus? So I stepped into the question of what was going on. I said, yes, Jesus, I want to accept the invitation to something different. And I started that process of coming to Jesus again and again in this little moment. So I usually have a process that kind of like I'll pull out my journal, I'll seek counsel, I'll make deliberate decisions about how to engage in things, and that's really, really good, but it does take a while, and it's not necessarily a momentary process. I'm indebted to a friend who recently shared the question he asks himself in those kind of moments, which is he pauses and he prays, Jesus, what unit of work do you want me to do in this case? And the wording struck me as odd, but I appreciated it because it implies each moment is a discrete choice. What unit do you want me to give in this section of time? Let me step over again. What unit do you want me to give in this section or this event that's going on? What unit here? And so I've been trying to apply that question to bring it into my life. So in this case, I asked Jesus, what unit of work do you want me to do as I've arrived home to the house? There's things everywhere. What's going and, you know, lots going on I need to catch up on. And you know what was awesome? Jesus said, no unit. You don't have to do anything. He invited me to sit on the couch and watch Dancing with the Stars and then hang out with my husband. Those things don't happen simultaneously because someone judges the show, but and it's not me. So that was great. That was an experience of the rest, right? It's like I need to stop the toiling and the auto drive I've been on here. And then I asked Jesus what I needed to do as I entered back into my work projects. And I didn't know there, right? There was a bunch of things going on I needed to pick back up. And I felt like what Jesus was saying is, it's time for you to work within the limit of the time you've set aside on these projects. You've been away. There's a lot going on. It's not time to give extra time, to dump more and more out. I'm inviting you to work with good, hard work in the time that's set. That, too, felt like rest to me. It wasn't kick it into overdrive and keep going. It was, let's pace this. You've been busy, and now it's time to shift and do something else. And there, in the coming again and again to let Jesus define what I'm meant to do, is how I learn to live in his rest, how I experience something different. And I'm grateful to say that most of the time right now, I would not describe my life as a bag of burdens climbing up a mountain. And often I'm quicker to catch it because of this work, this cultivation. I think that story was 12 years ago. I've been on a long road of learning how to recalibrate from what Jesus has asked me to do instead of everything I could possibly do and engage in. So to truly experience Jesus' rest, I think we all need to engage in some version of the three steps we saw in the passage, cultivating a childlike posture towards Jesus instead of that self-sufficiency, accepting Jesus' invitation to come and find rest for our souls, and repeatedly coming back and back to him again in a posture of need that lets him define the work and the burden. So as we close this morning, there's a few reflection questions on the screen. And I just invite you to think about, where could you release self-sufficiency? The questions are there, and maybe the chart of social indicators that came up before helps you think like, oh, that's a place that helps me notice, or that's something I'm doing right now, where I might be grabbing onto self-sufficiency. And where could you embrace the Lord's rest? You may want to ask that question I shared of, what unit of work do you want me to do in this case? So we'll give a few minutes of reflection, and our service will continue. Thank you.